we spend a lot of time here on Issues Etc. taking a look at the church, as broad as we can make that look at any one time. We spend a lot of time talking with reform groups from within mainline Protestant denominations, evaluating what's going on there. We'll do a little bit of that in the course of the first hour of Issues Etc. But first, we will be talking about the Episcopal Church USA and their gospel of social action. Is it faring well for the Episcopal Church USA to put all of its emphasis on the gospel of social action or social activism? In a lot of ways, and we'll see if our guest in the first half hour, Joyce Milton, agrees, in a lot of ways, the religious left is a perfect mirror image of the religious right. They both seem to have the same means, different aims. But we'll talk about that a little bit in the first half hour. Joyce Milton will join us. She's author of a column from National Review Online titled "Speak No Evil." Why can't leaders in the Episcopal Church USA use the word evil in a sentence without some sort of qualifier to indicate that they don't really believe the thing exists? Parker Williamson joins us in the second half hour of the program. The 215th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA will be taking place this week in Denver. They will be talking about the ordination of homosexuals. Whether they want to or not, they will be talking about it. We'll get Parker's take on that. And then in the second hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be spending some time talking about what your teenagers are spending on the prom. Did you know that it's a $1 billion business, proms? Between dresses, shoes, limos, and who knows what else the kids are buying, or mom and dad are buying for the kids, it's a $1 billion business. We'll talk about that and who your kids might be hearing at a commencement. Especially if they're going to a Catholic university, the bishops won't be showing up sometimes, depending on the commencement speaker. We'll talk about that and several other things during open lines. In the last hour of the program, Dr. Angus Manoos joins us. We'll be talking to him about postmodernism and hypersecularism. We'll find out what both of those isms are. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join us during these conversations and during open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joyce Milton is author of a column in National Review Online titled "Speak No Evil," dealing with the Episcopal Church USA. Joyce, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Todd.
Well, let's get that first question out of the way. You ask it in the course of your column. Why can't leaders in the Episcopal Church USA use the word evil in a sentence without qualifying it by some other modifier like simplistic or simple-minded?
Well, I mean, I think partly it's an attempt to bend over backwards and be tolerant and accept diversity. And partly it's a deep division in what morality really means. Years ago, John Dewey, the philosopher, said that in the future, morality wouldn't be so much about our personal behavior, but about social justice. And I think that outlook has deeply penetrated the seminaries. So being good means, you know, having a politically correct agenda, and it really isn't about whether given individuals are good or bad. Those terms, they kind of rankle with them.
So terms like evil would be reserved in those circles purely, not for what people would consider to be any moral evils per se, but things like poverty or war, social evils.
I guess so. I mean, it's hard. You don't find them using them much at all. You know, the examples that I cited, one of them involved Frank Griswold, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, who was just furious with George Bush because he used the term axis of evil. And Griswold said in this interview, "Quite apart from the bombs we drop, words are weapons, and we have used language so unwisely, so intemperately, so thoughtlessly, that I'm not surprised that we are hated and loathed everywhere we go." And then he talked about how embarrassed he was to go anywhere in the world and say he was an American. You know, in the same interview, the only thing he could say about Saddam Hussein and the leaders of North Korea and Iran was that they were hardly paragons of virtue. which kind of surprised me. I mean, how can it be so much worse to call a dictator evil than to actually be an evil dictator?
So what has gone wrong in the Episcopal Church USA with regard to, you talk about a gospel of social action. How would you define it, and what's its direction in the Episcopal Church?
Well, I mean, I think this has been a long-term historical trend. I mean, it's at one point, Episcopalians and most Protestants believed literally in the Bible, and then you had, an era when people interpreted the Bible, didn't take the words literally, and then another era which started decades ago, where religion kind of took a back seat, doctrine and faith, and the way to express your religion was through social action. And it's gotten to the point where you don't hear much about religion at all. I'm not speaking at the congregation level so much, where you do hear about issues of faith, but, you know, look on the church website, and it's as though you're looking at some kind of left-wing political party.
Well, you know, I've been to the website for the Episcopal Church USA and for other mainline Protestant denominations that have followed in their footsteps, and it has been striking. When I go to, say, the website for the National Council of Churches, I expect it to be kind of blatantly politicized. I expect there to be a lot there on foreign policy or domestic policy. That's where I expect to see it. But when I go to any of its members, say the Episcopal Church USA, I would expect something that is gives me a hint that I'm looking at a church body's
right, and you don't
website.
Find much, do you?
No.
You find prescriptions for, the Middle East and, what the Israelis and the Palestinians should do and so forth and so on. You don't find much about, how to feel the presence of God in your daily life. And I think that's one problem. It's first, it's all kind of left-wing pseudo-pacifism. I mean, I understand pacifism. I went to a Quaker college, but this is not based in morality so much as on, in politics. And, for most people, these have very little to do with why they want to go to church on Sunday.
Yeah, during the time of the Civil Rights Movement, I spoke recently with Father Richard John Newhouse, who was a mover and shaker in the Civil Rights Movement, and he seemed to sum up a balance that was struck there, or I guess I should say a proper emphasis that was struck there. They viewed their social action as part and parcel of the real Christian gospel, the message of salvation. They viewed that as a natural outgrowth. But it appears as though the heirs, the second generation heirs of that activism, have made a disconnect between anything doctrinal and the social action. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, in a way, this situation is a hangover from the civil rights era. I talk in my piece about Bishop Paul Moore, who died just a few weeks ago. And he also chose to use his very last sermon to denounce George Bush as a solitary Texan and so forth. And he came out of that era. And I think for many of these church leaders, that was the highlight of their life and their formative experience. And somehow they never got beyond it. I mean, they felt they were really doing something. When that struggle kind of wound down, they looked for the next thing, and it wasn't quite the same.
Why is George W. Bush the closest thing to which the social gospel types can find to the devil?
Well, he really is. He infuriates them. And one thing Bishop Moore said in his talk, he said, I believe it will lead to a terrible crack in the whole culture that we have come to know. And I think one reason they're so angry with Bush is that in the wake of 9/11, a lot of people who were formerly liberals are coming around to seeing the world more from George Bush's point of view, where there is good and there is evil, and American values are basically good. I mean, we're not perfect by any means. I'm not saying that. But we have to defend democracy and freedom. I live in New York here, and I knew a lot of people on the 10th of September who were liberals, and on the 11th of September, they were ready to drop nuclear bombs in Afghanistan. And I think George Bush actually did a rather good job of channeling some of that rage, you know, and saying, you know, our enemies are not innocent Muslims, they're terrorists.
He certainly could have monopolized on it if he wanted to at that moment.
Yes, I mean, I don't get a sense from people like Bishop Griswold that they understand how people felt. I mean, Bishop Griswold is really talking about how what we should learn from 9/11 is to enter into the suffering of other people based on our own suffering, which sounds to me like we should learn to behave more like victims. And I just don't think that's going to do it for most Americans.
So what? According to his way of thinking, the terrorists were simply just kind of bringing some of their suffering to bear upon us, and we should thank them for it?
Well, he doesn't say that, really, but you get the impression that he feels, you know, this was a humbling experience that took us down a peg, and that Western culture needs that. And, you know, I mean, I'm afraid that's what I get out of it.
So September 11th is like the old High Karate commercial where the guy gets a slap in the face and he says, thanks, I needed that.
That's right. Hmm. That's right. What amazed me is that he was really surprised when these comments attracted some attention and proved controversial, which makes me wonder, you know, who he talks to every day.
What was the general reaction, jumping forward several years, what was the general reaction of the leadership of the Episcopal Church USA to the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime?
Well, you know, there was no reaction, at least as far as, you know, the website, which has statements about everything all the time. The only thing they had on April 9th that they posted was a news story, and the headline was, Iraq Conflict Heightens Suspicions of U.S. Intentions. And they quoted an Anglican dean from Sheffield, England, who called the war a huge mistake. There was nothing about the toppling of the statue, the liberation of the Iraqi people. You know, it's like it never happened.
We're talking with Joyce Milton about the Episcopal Church and the Gospel of Social Action. She's author of the book, The Road to Malpsychia, Humanistic Psychology and Our Discontents. She's also written a recent column for National Review Online titled Speak No Evil. What are the great evils then, Joyce, of the Gospel of Social Action? If they had not a Ten Commandments, but a list of vices, if you will, what would they be with respect to the American foreign policy and domestic policy?
Well, having a national defense, you know, any form of militarism. They don't much like patriotism or nationalism. They want world government, which is nice in theory, but the question is how do you make it work, I suppose. You know, American arrogance, which, and they don't like capitalism, particularly. I could go down the list further, you know, but I don't think this is what most middle Americans believe. I made the joking suggestion in this article that the church has a lot of outreach offices. You know, for example, they have one for American Muslims, and I thought maybe they should have an outreach office for conservatives. But I would even broaden that and say an outreach office for middle America, where they make an attempt to communicate with us.
Yeah. How did they get so out of touch with not only middle America, but out of touch with the mainstream of American Protestantism?
I think, I don't know if they're really out of touch with the mainstream of American Protestantism, because I see this in other denominations as well. It's more of a division between the leaders, you know, the people who work in the central office and who work for these agencies like Peace and Justice Ministries, and the grassroots. And I really don't understand that, except the more you follow what they're doing, is these are people who spend an awful lot of time talking to one another, people from different denominations, going to conferences and so forth, and there's a whole agenda there that really doesn't have much to do with the average person who goes to church on Sunday and sits in the pew.
You spend some time talking about how they think money ought to be spent, as opposed to spending it on national defense. They want to talk about taking that money and using it to address the AIDS crisis in Africa, which is certainly something that needs to be addressed. But you raise this question. You ask, why is it clear that why religious leaders should be calling on government to take on the primary responsibility for fighting AIDS rather than mobilizing the faithful to do the job? It strikes me that we're looking here in the religious left at a mirror image of the religious right, which also expects the government to do, in some cases, its evangelizing.
Yeah, well, you know, Bishop Griswold says in one interview that America should be what he calls a super servant to the world, undertaking good deeds even at the expense of our own national interests. And I point out that the president and the Congress are elected by a diverse population. Many of them aren't even Christians, and they take an oath to uphold the interests of the United States. That's their job. Now, the church is a different story. So why isn't the church going to lead the effort to eradicate AIDS? I mean, you know, you can't expect government to do these things, but yet that seems to be their main function, is calling on government to solve these problems.
You mentioned Bishop Griswold before. What is, and those with whom he spends his time, what is their vision for America's rightful place in the world? Where, what should it be doing?
Well, as I said, we're going to be this super servant. You know, I mean, I don't think that people around the world are going to be much impressed by this, you know, if you want to know the truth. I don't think the people who already dislike us or would see this as anything but hypocritical. I mean, and unfortunately, a lot of things that people like Bishop Griswold would like to do are opposed by the very people he refuses to condemn as evil. You know, well, some dictators don't really want you to come in and try to solve their social problems. So it's a certain pie-in-the-sky mentality, I would say.
You also, since this is hot in the news, of course, with the roadmap to peace and peace talks on the horizon, you talk a bit about what advocates of the gospel of social action envision for American foreign policy and Middle East peace, in particular Israel and the Palestinian situation. What is it?
Well, yeah, one of the arguments that they made against the war in Iraq was that it would destabilize the Middle East. But when I look at their solution to the Israeli-Palestinian situation, it seems to me that would be even more destabilizing. And basically, they want Israel to give up everything, give the right of return to Palestinians, unconditional recognition of a Palestinian state, you know, immediate cessation of settlements. They criticize Israel for using American-made weapons, and so forth. And the Palestinians aren't expected to promise anything. And the way they're going to make this all work is you're going to have a multinational peacekeeping force made up of the UN, the European Union, the US, and Russia. Well, I mean, we've seen what the UN and the European Union are willing to do. So as far as I could see, this would end up with the US over there trying to somehow stop terrorism. The Israelis' problem would now be our problem. Very likely that would end in an all-out war, I would think.
Isn't that exactly the kind of thing in other circumstances they would decry America for becoming involved in?
Well, I mean, if we did those things and that's what happened, then, of course, we would still be wrong, wouldn't we? America would still be criticized no matter what it did. So it seems like you're in a cycle that you can't really get out of there.
So what is it about America at this point in its history, and where it stands now in respect to the rest of the world, that the advocates of the gospel of social action find not only so irritating, but so needful of condemnation? Is it that we're the lone world superpower? Is that just simply enough reason?
That's part of it, but it seems to go to something deeper. To, here are people who can no longer really say why it is that anyone should be Christian. They're so into being tolerant, and I certainly believe in tolerance, but they can't say that Christianity is more beneficial than any other religion in any way. And so it's like they've almost talked themselves out of having a reason for being. That's what I see. And so they really are kind of all at sea in terms of what their mission is.
So why Christianity at all? Why even maintain the facade of being bishop of this or overseer of a Christian congregation?
Well, I mean, that would be my question. I mean, if what really counts, and I should take my cues from this human rights cultural consensus, I don't need the church. And if I do need the church, I probably don't need this church, because that's really all it's putting forth. So they're kind of backed into a corner, and that's the way I see it, I'm afraid. The Episcopalians have a plan to double their church membership over the next decade or so, and I don't see how it's going to happen.
Do you have any sense, finally, Joyce, how the Episcopal Church USA and those we've been discussing, the advocates of the gospel of social action, at least the leadership, how they view the average Episcopalian sitting in the pew who still does believe the doctrines of the faith, who, deal, when they hear the word gospel, still does think of a message of salvation in Jesus Christ rather than one's personal beliefs about foreign policy vis-a-vis the Middle East or something like that? Do you have any idea how they view that kind of...
I think the leadership feels that they have the enlightened and forward-looking position and that their job is to shepherd people who haven't quite come around yet to seeing things their way. That's how I see it. I mean, and my feeling is that they're in the grip of intellectual trendiness, you know, whose day has more or less passed and is on the wane. But I don't think that they have any glimmer that that might be the case.
Joyce Milton, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Joyce Milton is author of the book The Road to Malpsychia, Humanistic Psychology and Our Discontents, and she's also written a recent column for National Review Online titled Speak No Evil. You can read it on the internet at nationalreview.com. That's nationalreview, all one word, .com. You can look at this and say, well, this is just anti-Americanism, or it's just blame America first and it's part of the culture. I don't think that's it. Not in its first case. I don't think the reason behind the gospel of social action and a church that can say, that can spend hours and weeks and web pages blathering on about American foreign policy or domestic policy and say absolutely nothing about the content of the Christian faith has to do with the fact that they're anti-American to begin with. I think it has to do with the fact that they have given up what they were all about in the first place. A church that abandons the genuine gospel, the gospel which is a message of salvation in Jesus Christ, not a cure for social ills, but God's solution for sin in Christ and Him crucified, is really left with little more to say, little to say to the world at all than well, look, we need to start cleaning up our act. We need to start taking care of poverty. What else do you have to say if you have no real message? When you give up the gospel of Jesus Christ, what are you left with then? A gospel of mere social action and activism. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What does the truly spiritual life look like? How is it lived? Do the stations we occupy in life, father, mother, husband, wife, employee, citizen, do these have anything to do with our spiritual life? What is the Christian doctrine of vocation? Find out how God hides Himself in the ordinary tasks of life in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can order The Spirituality of the Cross by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, or order online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on the country of Nepal, where Christians can face severe trials, but also joy. The mission agency Gospel for Asia reports that 34 people recently made a public profession of their faith in Jesus Christ. One man became a Christian in a prison where he met a Nepalese believer named Manya. Last year, Manya received a 20-year sentence for a murder that he didn't commit, but his suffering through an unjust sentence has had positive eternal results. There's a lot of good news from Nepal, where the number of Christians more than doubled from 1990 to 2000, and that was during a period when government officials were putting Christians in jail for their faith. The Missions Handbook Operation World says the first Nepali leaders did a good job preparing a second generation of believers. Pray for Christ to be glorified in Nepal. Pray for spiritual needs worldwide by logging on to missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The Duke of Windsor died on this date in 1972. He had abdicated the throne of England in 1936 to marry his love, Wallace Warfield Simpson. Ah, romance. Ah, love. At the other extreme, there's the Divorce Bus. Once a month, the Divorce Bus makes its run in Miami-Dade County, serving people who have filed for an uncontested divorce. The Washington Post reports that one day the Divorce Bus facilitated 26 divorces in 45 minutes. C.S. Lewis observed that being in love is a feeling, and no feeling lasts forever. But of course, he wrote, ceasing to be in love need not mean ceasing to love. Love in this second sense, love as distinct from being in love, is not merely a feeling. It's a deep unity, maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit. It is on this love that the engine of marriage is run. Being in love was the explosion that started it. So stay off the bus. Get out your willpower and spend some time today tuning up the engine of your marriage.
This Thursday, May 29th, many Christian churches will offer worship services commemorating the ascension of our Lord. AM 850K, if you will carry a live broadcast of one such service from Ascension Lutheran Church in St. Louis. The program begins at 7 p.m. Once again, that's a live Ascension Worship Service broadcast on Thursday, May 9th, from Ascension St. Louis, here on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christian Radio for the World.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Ascension of Jesus Christ, Dr. Norman Nagel of Concordia Seminary joins us. Tomorrow is Ascension Day in the church calendar, you know, and we'll also be talking about Catholicism today with Pastor Rolf Preuss. We'll spend the last half hour of this first hour of Issues Etc. on a similar subject to the one of the last half hour. The 215th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA started on Saturday, will run for 1 week in Denver. Now, there have been some shenanigans in the Presbyterian Church USA in the last year over the issue of the ordination of homosexuals to the clergy. The shenanigans we'll hear about, and we'll find out whether or not this will be a subject. This is already a subject at the 215th General Assembly of that, the largest Presbyterian church body in the United States. Joining us to talk about that, our regular guest here, Pastor Parker Williamson. He's executive editor of the Presbyterian Layman, and he joins us from the assembly in Denver. Parker, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much. It's good to talk with you again.
First of all, give us your general reaction to how the General Assembly has unfolded so far.
Oh, this is a tough assembly. But almost every General Assembly is. You know, it's like undergoing a root canal once a year. But we're here, and things are moving along. They elected Susan Andrews, who is a member of the Covenant Network, a group that is in favor of ordaining homosexuals. So that was an unhappy experience right at the very beginning. She was elected as moderator. The person who was running against her, Harold Kurtz, is a career missionary. So they had a clear choice, and they chose the liberal. There's been a real push here to, again, get before the Presbyterian people motion to do away with our ordination standards that say that we will ordain and install only persons who confine their sexual behavior to marriage. Everything goes to a committee before it goes out to the floor. And in the committee, by 6 votes, they have voted to send that back out to the people. However, I really think that the fat lady hadn't sung on that one, and we may see on the floor a different vote. I'm hoping and praying that's the case. Presbyterians are awfully weary having to deal with that issue. And the will of the church is very, very well known. My goodness, the last time we sent this thing out to the people, the vote was 3-1 in favor of keeping the standards in place in our Constitution. So
now, there was an attempt, and you need to go back through the story for us if you could. You've done it before, but this is a story that bears repeating. There was an attempt to bring a special assembly on the particular issue of the ordination ban, and that was somehow thwarted. The news stories all make it sound like, well, you know, it was going to happen, and then it just so happened that some of the signers withdrew their names from a petition. How did it really go down, Parker?
Yeah, the Presbyterian Church has a provision that if 50 commissioners to the General Assembly, half of them ministers, half elders from a variety of presbyteries, if they sign a petition calling for a special meeting of their General Assembly, then the moderator is obliged to call it. So 57 did so, and when the moderator was presented with the petitions, there was great consternation. He and the stated clerk got together, that's our chief legal officer, got together, and they decided that they needed to validate these names, make sure that they really were the case. So they sent a letter to the 57 people saying, you know, do you really want a General Assembly? And by the way, we just hope you won't. And in the meantime, since half of these were ministers who were career people in the church, they got special pressure from their executives and people whose recommendations would be pretty important if they were ever going to serve any church other than the church they're now serving. And so then shortly thereafter, several people withdrew their names from the petition. When it dropped below the magic 50, then the moderator declared that he would not call a special meeting because he didn't have a petition with 50 names on it. But there was a lot of arm twisting and just a lot of inappropriate behavior there.
Did I read recently that the moderator was ruled to have acted improperly in this case?
That's correct. The thing was taken to the highest court by one of a local church who just said, look, this is ridiculous. They took it to the highest court, and the court ruled that the moderator acted inappropriately. But it didn't do anything about the decision, the ruling. So here we are now in the middle of another General Assembly, and we've got all kinds of things happening around here. There are the sexuality issues. There are the abortion issues. The Presbyterian Church last year voted that under certain circumstances it was moral to conduct a partial birth abortions, that terrible procedure. Well, since then, you know, the United States Senate has proven itself more moral than the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA. And we were hoping that this General Assembly would reconsider its radical left stance on abortion. But it does not look like it's going to do it.
The Presbyterian Church USA has roughly 2.5 million members nationwide. How are those numbers faring?
Yeah, and falling fast. Well, we've lost 1.7 million members since 1965. We lost 41,000 this past year. And every year it's a loss. I think it was about 35,000 the previous year. So The numbers are falling. The income is falling. This denomination is facing major budget crises. They're having to cut back in lots of categories, and but never in the right categories. They chop out missionaries rather than to do away with the Washington political lobby or the World Council of Churches or the National Council. Interesting thing happened this morning. They had what was billed as a worship service. It was to be an ecumenical worship service, and the preacher was a Cuban minister, seminary professor from Cuba. And he, once he got on the pulpit there, he lit into George Bush and the war on Iraq, saying that we had made war on the Iraqi people, and we had it was unconscionable that orphans that we had caused by our action over there, and then of course lit into us for sanctions against Cuba. And a hundred or so people walked out of the worship service. They said, look, this is not worship. This is rank, pure politics, and we don't want any part of it. So it has been a raucous assembly at this point, and I think we're going to see some real developments in the next couple of days. As it now, it goes out of committee, and all these proposals from the various committees go into the General Assembly itself, the big session.
The election of Susan Andrews to be moderator there, and you mentioned before that she was a member of a group that has been pushing for the repeal of the ban on homosexual ordination in the Presbyterian Church USA. Does this in any way in your mind signal the Assembly's thought on the homosexual ordination issue?
It's hard to tell. I suspect that they do have the votes. But the fact of the matter is, having the votes here in this General Assembly is one thing, but out there in the out there where the people are, it's quite a different matter. The Covenant Network, the group that Andrews is part of, has declared that it would not support sending this matter back out to the people this year. And it said that's not because we don't believe in it, but it's because we don't really want another loss. They've had three straight losses on this. In 1996, we put the ordination standard in the Constitution. 1997, it was tested, and the people voted 2-1 to keep it there. And then in 2001, the referendum went out, and the people voted 3-1 to keep that standard in the Constitution. So the trend has been toward biblical orthodoxy. The trend has been toward keeping the standards. And that Covenant Network realizes that. For crying out loud, they don't want to put something out there for a vote among the people and get beaten again. They would rather work for a while to develop their political alliances before they send it out to the people. So the liberals themselves, in other words, are divided at this assembly, and that may make a difference when it comes to the vote on this thing on the floor.
Even if it came up for a vote on the assembly floor during this week there in Denver, and by some miracle, it sounds like, the repeal was voted down and the ban would stay according to the assembly, that wouldn't silence those who want the ordination of homosexuals in the Presbyterian Church USA, would it?
Oh, no. They're a very active lobby, and they work very hard at what they do.
I can't think of a greater disparity, at least on a moral issue, Parker, between the General Assembly, it's what it seems to be voting out three times and having rejected by the Church three times, than this particular issue. How bad is that disparity between the leadership, the General Assembly, and the people sitting in the pews of Presbyterian churches?
Well, I think the fact that, let's take the last time around on that thing, the General Assembly, by a vote of probably a split of 60-40, voted to do away with those standards, and then, of course, because that is a constitutional standard, it went out to the people. The people returned it with a 3-1 vote against what they did. So that's an enormous disparity. This General Assembly does not, it's heavily dominated by the staff, and it does not reflect where Presbyterians are in the pews. That's the good news, but it's also the bad news, of course.
We're talking about the 215th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA, the largest Presbyterian church body in the United States. It's taking place this week in Denver. It began on Saturday, and speaking to us from the General Assembly is Parker Williamson, executive editor of the Presbyterian Layman. If you'd like to call us with a question or a comment, then you feel free to do so. It's 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Parker, what about the faculties at the seminaries of the Presbyterian Church USA? Have any of the members of those seminaries spoken out on this particular issue?
Yes. Our seminaries, that's a mixed bag, but most of our seminaries are heavily controlled by liberal thinking. And these are tenured professors. They've been in there for a while, and it's pretty hard to get one out of there. In several of our mainline seminaries, we have a very strong lobby for this homosexual activism. It's a most disconcerting thing. We have a few seminaries that are very fine. Pittsburgh Seminary seems to be doing much, much better. The climate there is changing, and Dubuque Seminary is just an outstanding one. But Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia is—I wouldn't send my dog to that seminary. I happen to have graduated from it. But when you've got professors there who deny the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, well, I'm sitting here and thinking, you know what Paul said, what the Scripture says. You know, if Christ has not been raised from the grave, our faith is futile. We're dead in our sins. We're most of all to be pitied. And I'm looking and saying, how in the world can a seminary in a mainline denomination have come to the point that it would employ people like that? What in the world do they preach on Easter Sunday?
It's a great question. Let's go to the phones, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Parker Williamson how he would appraise the situation at Chicago, where I believe his church body has a seminary that shares a close premises and or cross-registration of classes with a ELCA seminary. Is that situation one where these extremes are calculated and nurtured?
It's a good question, Herman. Thank you very much. What about the joint seminary in Chicago?
Yeah, you're referring to the McCormick Theological Seminary, I believe, the Presbyterian Seminary, and that seminary is heavily oriented toward what they call progressive theology. You do see in that seminary professors who do not hold to traditional faith, and that is that seminary has been a hotbed of homosexual activism. So I really feel sorry for the evangelical Lutherans that they've gotten connected with us there. We're not giving them our best, I can assure you of that.
Are gays and lesbians being ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA right now?
Yes, they are. Have been for some time, though mostly in closet fashion. But what we have experienced in the last couple of years now is we've experienced a situation where some churches and some ministers, not a lot, but enough to be concerned about, are openly defying the ordination standards. And what is really troubling about that, I mean, you're always in any organization going to have some people who defy the standards, but what really troubles us is that those who are responsible for enforcing the standards, for ensuring compliance, are simply looking the other way. They're not enforcing the standards, and that includes the stated clerk of the General Assembly, our highest constitutional officer.
We spoke to you rather recently about a particular minister, his name escapes me right now, who had been defying the ban on the ordination of gays and lesbians in the Presbyterian Church USA. He had been defying the ban on homosexual marriage. He was tried, found guilty, but basically just said, well, what you did was wrong, now go your way. And he said, I'm going to keep doing it.
Yep. That fellow, his name is Ben Kiken, and he is in Cincinnati and Mount Auburn Presbyterian Church. And it was very interesting. He stood before the court. The court said, look, we do not marry people of the same gender in the Presbyterian Church. You cannot conduct a ceremony and call it a marriage. And you have done this. They looked at the church bulletin and all of that, which, of course, he had put on the Internet. I mean, he's one of these in-your-face people. So they said, we're going to find you guilty. They rebuked him, which is the tiniest punishment you can give. They could have removed him from the ministry, but they rebuked him. So he stood before the court and said, well, I just want to inform you that I'm going to do it again. And sure enough, a couple of Sundays ago, he performed another same-sex marriage, and he put the church bulletin on the Internet and advertised the fact that he had done so. I really think he, you know, even the liberals in that presbytery are getting a little embarrassed by this in-your-face blatant defiance, and so we hope maybe some next time around the court will say, well, now, wait a minute, maybe something has to happen here. But isn't it tragic? I mean, people who in the Presbyterian Church, when they're ordained, they take vows, ordination vows, and they promise to live under the Constitution of the Church. And it's amazing when we have folks who openly just declare, well, I'm not going to, that one doesn't apply to me.
Parker, you mentioned that the gay and lesbian ordinations are taking place in the Presbyterian Church USA. What good is a ban, even one that's in place and continues to be upheld by the presbyteries again and again, what good is it if it is defied and unenforced?
Well, good question. Of course, a constitution that is not enforced is not a constitution. It's as simple as that. And, you know, as you can tell from my voice, I'm a Southerner, and I can remember when segregated schools were segregated, and the Brown decision, Supreme Court decision declaring that unlawful. I remember Little Rock High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, where some black children applied to go to school there and were told they couldn't because they were black. And so here you had a law, the law of the land, you had it interpreted by the Supreme Court, and you had a state, a particular school board that was defying it. President Eisenhower at that time stepped in there and placed the National Guard in front of that school and flanked the opening to that school and escorted those little children into the school. He did exactly the right thing. And when he did it, he said, look, what I'm really doing, it's not just a matter of supporting these girls who wish to go to this school, but I am defending the Constitution of the United States of America. Because if the Constitution can be defied, we have no Constitution, and therefore we become a lawless society. And that I wish that Presbyterians in high places would understand the meaning of that. This knife can cut both ways. And this is going to come back to bite them.
When you walk through the halls of this General Assembly in Denver, how do your liberal colleagues and opponents treat you?
I would say something like the skunk at the picnic. You know, it's I'm publicly raising issues that many of them wish could be kept under wraps. But that's my job. That's what I'm here to do. And I thank God for the resources and the support of his people that enables me to do that.
What would you say to a church body like mine? It's roughly a kind of a correspondent to yours, 2.5 million people, a past history of being very staunchly conservative and confessional in its own right. But there are some voices in the church body like mine that would call for us to move in the direction that many of the leadership of the Presbyterian Church USA seem to want to move. What would you say to a church body like mine?
I would encourage your church body to look very carefully at the scriptures and not to do anything, no matter how politically correct, not to do anything that violates the Word of God. You know, these politically correct positions, they may look powerful today and but they are dust, And that is exactly where they're going to end, on the garbage heap of history. Better to stick with God's word, because we know that his word will not return to him void, but will accomplish that for which he has purposed it.
Do you ever want to give up, Parker?
Not on your life. For me to give up would be for me to just simply step away from a call that God has laid on my life. I don't have that luxury to do that, but neither do you, which is why you're sitting at that microphone where you are.
So to say, look, I'm done with the PCUSA, it's the PCA for me, or some other Presbyterian church body where I wouldn't have to fight these fights, is not an option for you at this point.
Well, it really isn't, because God placed me in this garden. This is the garden I'm supposed to tend, and it's got some weeds in it, but we have to deal with it. And of course, the fact of the matter is, any church is made up of people. We understand that people are sinful. I don't think you're going to find a denomination anywhere that is pristine, pure. And you mentioned PCA. They have some problems of their own. And I'm quite sure that that many of those problems will grow and have to be confronted. So better, in my judgment, to be where the Lord placed you and to try to live that life with integrity.
Parker Williamson, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc., and keep up the good work. I hope for a favorable outcome at that 215th General Assembly, and if not, you just fight that much harder.
Thanks so much. We're right in there. Bye-bye.
Parker Williamson is executive editor of the Presbyterian Layman. He joins us from Denver at the 215th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA. If you'd like information on how to receive the Presbyterian Layman, you can call them toll-free, 1-800-368-0110. That's 1-800-368-0110. Or you can check out the website for the Presbyterian Layman at layman.org. That's LAYMAN.ORG. Their phone number, 1-800-368-0110. It's said in the world of politics and in the world of civil interaction that the cost of liberty is constant vigilance. And this makes perfect sense, doesn't it? We live in a world where liberty is always at stake. It always is. And we have learned in liberty-loving society to always be vigilant, to be suspicious of things that often appear to offer us a better alternative than to liberty, right? That's what it is to be an American. I think it is true that what it is to be a truth-loving Christian, a gospel-loving Christian, is not to say, well, we will compromise to further the gospel. That's how all these things begin, you know. We'll bring more people into the church if we just have homosexuals in the clergy. No, the cost of the truth and the cost of the gospel is also constant vigilance. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.